You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Filmmaking Conversations with Damian Swabey. Listen to conversations with award-winning filmmakers, directors from the golden age of television, and creatives from the indie film community who continue to inspire the next generation of filmmakers. And now, over to your host, Damian Swabey.
Zana Thyrus, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing absolutely well. I've got you on the podcast. I've got one of the most inspirational podcast hosts, micro-budget filmmakers, on the podcast. So I'm over the moon. I've got a lot to say to you. I've got a lot of questions.
I'm excited. I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, anytime at all. Now, you pretty much embody the indie filmmaker spirit. It's clear to see. You don't just talk the talk or walk the walk. You back it up, and you've proven that on many, many occasions. And I always wonder the reason why some people are so dedicated and so passionate about independent film and are able to continue to make stuff time and time again. Mm-hmm. So you yourself, what is it about independent film that you love so much?
I think that as a filmmaker, the types of stories that I want to tell are so special to me. I don't like just making films for the sake of making films. I always want my films to have an activist-centered theme. I love using film as a vehicle to drive social change. So a lot of my projects, they've been around reproductive justice or sexual trauma recovery or Black feminism, or even with the comedy stuff, like it's always very intentional with the work that I do. And knowing that the usual Hollywood model is to like write a script, a multi-million dollar script, and to go pitch it and try to sell it. And for me, the stories that I make are too precious for me to give away to someone else for them to have autonomy over it. So it's important for me as an independent filmmaker to have full autonomy over the work that I create, how I make it, who I make it with. I want all of my film sets to be filmed with people who believe in the vision, believe in the film. And you know, a lot of the downside to working with, you know, these major networks and major studios is that your film is not your own. Your film is not your own. You know, it's completely up to them. And from who you bring onto the project all the way to the final edit and how it's distributed. I don't like putting my filmmaking in the hands of anyone else but me. So that's really why I do what I do. Also, big major studio productions, they give me a headache. they really do. They give me a headache. I like to tell people I make commercials by day and movies by night. My day job is a commercial producer in the advertising world. I've been making commercials, producing commercials for about 5 years now. And some of these sets that I've been on, I mean, it's like 50, 60 people. Sometimes it's two people doing one thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's these, the longest shoots I've been on, there were two back-to-back 12-hour days. So 24 hours on a shoot, all for 30 seconds, a 30-second commercial. And for me, it's like the filmmaking shouldn't be stressful. It shouldn't be stressful. I am the filmmaker that's like, I don't want to have to wait to be funded. I don't want to have to wait to convince investors. I also don't want to have to pull together a team of 50 people just to do one thing. Independent filmmaking allows me to make films that I care about with skeleton crews. And that's what allows me to create consistently. So it just works for me all around.
So you say skeleton crews, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a crew of five, a crew of 10, or even a crew of three? On average with your independent projects, how many crew members do you have?
There's no average. Each film, I look at each and every film as a very individual, nuanced project, and each project requires something different. I've filmed silent films in my former boss's, one of his apartments with my three friends, And that crew was only three people with two actors. My last project that I did, that was one of the largest crews I've worked with, but it was less than 20 people. So anywhere from, like, I would say a set of 5 to 25 is usually around, and that's including post-production, color, sound mix, like all the way through. But I would say anywhere from like 5 to 25.
That's amazing. And you're in a situation where you have complete ownership of your films. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they're centered around activism sometimes. And I've noticed that in some of your work. And there was one film in particular that was related to sexual trauma. Mm-hmm. So when you're working on a film that's close and potentially personal to you, mm-hmm. are you working with crew members that are friends or family or acquaintances, or are you going out there and hiring them the same way anyone else would?
I work with a lot of my friends on a lot of my projects, for reasons that you've listed. They're very deeply personal projects, and I also, a huge part of my network is filmmakers. Mm. So I tend to work with people that I am most comfortable collaborating with on my projects. It's rare that I bring on a stranger, just because I want to know them as people. You know, mm-hmm. I want to be able to trust that they have my back, that they believe in my vision, that it can create a set environment where it feels like a family reunion as opposed to like work.
I like that. Family reunion. That's very nice. And yeah. And such a place you can let yourself go and just and be who you want and how you want without maybe the fear of judgment. But yeah. The film itself is called Unlearning Sex, which won. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm saying, mm-hmm, yes, I'm agreeing.
Okay, yeah. The film itself is called Unlearning Sex, and it won Best Human Rights Film at the Toronto International Women's Festival and the Silver Award at the Spotlight Documentary Film Awards and many other festivals. It done really, really well. Mm-hmm. You have put yourself out there. Can you tell us a bit about the subject matter for those of us who haven't watched it? And why did you put it out? And how did you feel discussing this at festivals or panels or on your own podcast?
So Unlearning Sex followed my 6-month journey through sexual trauma therapy and recovery. I worked with an incredible therapist who specialized in narrative exposure therapy. So she helped people use language and words to rewrite their stories, and also paired that with like mediums of art. And so mine was, of course, filmmaking and documenting. Initially, I had no intention of releasing this film. I had no intention of making this film accessible. But as I went through that 6-month process, I realized, listening back to audio clips from my therapy sessions, and I also recorded them because I had gone to therapy before, and I remember being like, oh, my therapist said this one thing and I don't remember what it is. So I was recording that for me, and listening back to it, I realized how much I had changed in just like 2 months' time, and then 3 months, and then 4 months. And by the 6-month mark, I couldn't even recognize who I was at the very beginning of that process. And I had shifted so much that I personally was like, I feel like it would be, I just had the desire to share that with other people so that they would be inspired to go after their healing as well. And so what I did was compile some of those clips from therapy. And again, it's a 30-minute film, but there are hours and hours and hours of audio clips. I only put in very small nuggets. And I paired that with roundtable interviews from sexologists, sexual education, folks, therapists, and I coupled that journey with me documenting myself, focusing on reclaiming my autonomy as well. So I saw a lot of films surrounding, you know, sexual assault, and a lot of times they were not intersectional. It was important for me to bring on therapists and educators who were Black and Brown and queer and non-binary. It was a very diverse group of educators that were a part of this project, and also partnering with a university library distributor to distribute the film, because the goal was not the accolades and festivals, although it was really nice to bring that to social justice centered festivals and have those discussions. It's primarily for sex ed programs at schools. And it's done very well in that realm. It's been licensed by Harvard University's University Library, among 20 others and counting. And it's also screened with a lot of different organizations, like the there's indigenous groups and groups in Africa who have screened it as well. And it's just started so many necessary conversations and inspired a lot of people. And ultimately that was the goal.
Well done. That's amazing that you've been able to put it out there and it's achieved its goal. Take my hat off to you completely. But how does the feedback compare from Harvard University and universities like that, that you would receive compared to more traditional festivals and places and film organizations?
I usually get responses directly from students. So students whose schools have licensed the program will reach out to me via Instagram, or they'll find me on Twitter, or they'll find my email, and they'll say just how much the film changed their lives. And you know, festivals are awesome, but there's a lot of people at the festival circuit who will comment on, you know, how well-crafted the story was. So usually the film festivals will comment on things specifically related to the craftsmanship of the film, and students are the ones who usually comment on the subject matter itself.
I see. And that makes sense. I can understand the differences there. And because of your political stance and activism, which is obviously a part of your filmmaking, is that something that's been with you from an early age? Or is that something you've got caught up in as a filmmaker or in your personal young adult life?
I would say it's definitely been with me from an early age, although I didn't have the language to actually name it. I didn't have the language to actually, you know, say, oh, I'm an intersectional feminist, or I believe in intersectionality, or, you know, like these are the things that are important to me. So I didn't always have that language. I think that filmmaking definitely opened the portal to me being more educated in these subjects and in the things that I care about, specifically because I do a lot of educational documentaries. So I'm working with a lot of scholars, I'm working with a lot of therapists, I'm working with a lot of people who this is their expertise. It's always been there, but it's definitely grown.
Brilliant. I wondered if it had or hadn't, or how it came apart, how it became something that you believe in, something that you work in. Because after watching your documentary, The Secret Life of Your Local Government, which is another great one, I wondered how you got a free speech lawyer and an associate professor of political science and people such as that as to be a part of your documentary, and what they must have thought about you as you approached them, or did they approach you? So how did that documentary come about, and where were you in your career when you decided to make that documentary?
Very early on, I had just recently graduated. It was like a semester that I graduated from film school. And that was like one of the very first documentaries that I ever produced. That one specifically, I think the thing about educational documentaries is that a lot of people are not giving scholars or politicians or educators a platform to kind of flaunt their stuff, for lack of better words. No one's usually coming up to a free speech lawyer like, hey, can you star in my documentary? So I've never, even with my documentary Black Feminist, which is also internationally awarded and traveled, like there's a lot of professors and teachers who were part of that film who were like, you know, people, there's never an opportunity for me to sit here and talk about my expertise and you know, dive into the subject in front of a camera and it get distributed, you know, like, so I've never had anybody say no, and I'm grateful for that. But it's really just because I find the people who are an embodiment of what the film's mission is. And so it's kind of a no-brainer.
So finding people that are the embodiment of what the film is, how hard is that? Because there's a lot of people that are naturally going to be the embodiment of it. But how many of these people are prepared to talk to you, prepared to travel to you, and prepared to actually be in front of camera. Because I think a lot of us, we find people that we're like, oh, great, that person's spot on for the documentary. And then you approach them and then you pitch to them or whatever. And they're like, oh, I don't really want to be in front of the camera, or I can't do it because of X, Y, Z. How do you get over those type of problems? And have you had any of those problems in the past before?
I haven't had any of those problems. Yeah. I always put together a production deck for every single one of my films. The documentary decks have the outline of the subject. They have a link to my previous work, so people see the documentaries that I've done and where they've been distributed. They also have the subject matter and how the film will be broken down, as well as interview questions and where it'll be filmed, and a production schedule, along with a distribution plan, so they know where the film will be distributed. So my goal with sending out my production decks to anybody I'm interested in having as a part of the documentary is for them to have no questions. And so I try to make my production decks as thorough as possible. I also either will film locally and find people that are local and can easily come to the set, or I will travel them in, or I will travel to them. So the goal is never for them to be inconvenienced by being a part of this project. I also film majority of my documentaries in one place. Nice. So Black Feminist, we filmed part of it in an Airbnb. The other part of it, we filmed in stairwells at a museum. And it was located in Chicago. And most of everybody that was a part of the film was also in Chicago.
And you yourself, are most of your project based in Chicago, Illinois, or do you get to travel around a bit?
Most of my projects are actually based in Atlanta, Georgia. And then the other half are based in Chicago.
And why Atlanta?
Atlanta is a very, very, very progressive and diverse film scene. There's also a lot of hungry independent filmmakers who want to jump on projects that have potential and that have that are likely going to be distributed in the festival circuit. You get a lot of very green filmmakers who want to have an opportunity to work on a well-oiled machine of an independent film set. Also, the subject matters of my films are a lot more well-received in Atlanta than they are in Chicago. So a lot of my shorts and some of my doc stuff has been filmed in Atlanta.
Now, as far as I'm aware, you're from Chicago. So why do you feel that your work's well-received in Atlanta a lot more than it is in Chicago?
I think the demographic. Atlanta is full of Black independent filmmakers. Chicago is still incredibly segregated. It's also the independent film scene is more of a funnel. People don't come to Chicago to make films. People usually come to Chicago to grow their network and will likely, this is a pit stop on their way to LA or on their way to New York or on their way elsewhere. It's not necessarily an independent film hub. There's great schools here, but again, it's usually it's a funnel. It's a pass through. People come to Chicago for what they come to Chicago for, and then they go. Whereas Atlanta is where people flock specifically to make films. And by people, I mean Black independent filmmakers. So I meet a lot of filmmakers who have shared interests in Atlanta.
I see. It completely makes sense then. It's if that's where you need to go, or if that's where people want to go, or it's a hub and it's the place to be in that way for independent filmmakers, why not? It's a no-brainer.
Right.
A lot of us, when we're doing self-shooting projects or projects with small crews or even projects with big crews, we're the producer, director, and writer. And that can be a bit difficult or stressful at times. Now, you've proven to be able to do all three on your projects. Is there any times you've been really kind of stressed or felt, oh, I can't do this, or I need someone to take over more of the production side of things? And if there has been, can you tell us one time?
Yeah, so as I grow as a filmmaker, I have started bringing on a co-producer to all of my projects. So whether it's a short or documentary, like I said, I always start off with a production deck. And after the production deck is done, I bring on a co-producer to help manage the logistics of the project. And that co-producer will have a PA to help them run those logistics so that I can focus on the creative. So I put together the production decks, whether it's a documentary, it's more the subjects, the mood boards, the questions that will be asked, the distribution plan. For short films, it's got the pre-production, production, and post-production schedule, the script breakdown, the budget, all of the distribution plan and marketing. It's pretty much a full out. It has like templates as well for contracts, whether it be the location released or a crew release form. It's a full fleshed out production deck that I can hand to a co-producer and say, this is all you need to like move forward. And then from there, we'll have weekly check-ins, weekly production meetings of like our checklist of like what we need to get done. And I can dedicate the rest of that production time to focusing on the directing aspects. So working on my shot list and working on the prop list and production design and working with actors and things like that.
Wow, that is amazing. I can see why you would do that. It gives you, like you say, more time to direct and concentrate in a different way. And when you're working with crews and their family and their friends, just sometimes things maybe get a bit too familiar. Because I've spoken to filmmakers in the past who have worked with family and girlfriend and boyfriends working together and things like that, and it's become maybe too close for comfort. Have you had situations like that? And if you had, how did you overcome those situations? Because from what I've seen, all of your films work. They don't look like they've had any major issues in them.
Yeah, I haven't had any major issues. It helps like a lot of my friends are filmmakers. I'm not like, hey, my cousin that I haven't seen in 3 years, want to come make a film? Like, that's not how I'm putting together my teams. But I don't know. I tend to work with people that love the project and respect the work that that you know we're doing. And it's although it's fun and it does feel like a family reunion, like everyone understands that we're there to make a film. So I haven't had any problems.
That's great. No throwing cameras at anyone or hitting someone with a boom. I love that. There's none.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you do commercials, you produce them. And I saw one for Pepsi in a restaurant as well. The food looked lovely. I mean, if I was over there, I would definitely check out that restaurant from what I saw on the table. How do you balance working those gigs with your own independent projects as well? Because a lot of us have trouble finding the balance. And sometimes the commercial work or the corporate work or the broadcast network work kind of overrides the personal and the projects that are full of passion for the filmmaker. How do you deal with that? And is it a problem for you?
So I would say the important thing, well, let me back up. The Pepsi job was the first commercial that I produced, that I directed. I didn't produce that commercial, I directed it.
Okay, sorry.
I guess you could say I have three different lives. I'm an independent filmmaker. I produce and direct and write my own films. I work my full-time day job as a commercial producer. And then outside of that, I'm signed to a roster where I direct commercials. So those are three different things. The most consistent is my day job. And I don't think that having a job and being a filmmaker, that there's anything wrong with that at all.
No.
I know a lot of filmmakers who are, you know, they're cut out to just drop everything and move to LA and sleep on couches or wait tables or bartend and like, you know, try to sell their scripts. And kudos to them. You know, it's so ambitious and admirable. But like, for me, I was not capable of going that route. I was like, no, like I want to know every 2 weeks what my paycheck is going to look like so that after my bills are paid, I know how much I have left over to go make this film.
Oh, yes.
And I wanted to find consistency that way. And taking the micro budget approach, you know, if I'm not spending more than $5,000 on a film, I can make a film or two a year. And that to me is like that level of consistency, autonomy, and being able to make that with the people that I love, you know, hey, friends, pull up to this Airbnb this weekend and we're gonna make a film. That approach consistently, and then being able to take those films and get them in festivals and they're traveled all over the world means so much more to me than trying to convince someone, you know, to pick up my feature or to sell this project. So I think the way that I'm able to balance it all is by having my priorities in place. My priority is my day job, because that's going to create this consistency for my independent work. Outside of that, as a commercial director, commercial directing is not consistent. You know, I'm put up for jobs all the time, then I'm going against 50 other directors, you know, like I'm lucky if I get one. And I don't take that personally, because I work as a commercial producer and I know how hard it is to narrow down a director. So it's not real until it's real. You know, there's a lot of, oh, we have this project that came through and, you know, it's we think you'd be a good fit for it. Do you want us to submit you? Sure. But I might not hear anything from that. You know, like I'm not overwhelmed by it, because it's not something that's a day-to-day, everyday thing. When it happens, it happens. But most importantly, being a commercial producer, as stressful as it is, it's nice to be reminded of why I do what I do. And that's for the consistency of independent filmmaking.
Excellent. I love what you said about having films for under $5,000. Mm-hmm. Gives you the chance to make more than one film a year.
Right.
Especially with the technology now we have and everything, it's mind-boggling what we can achieve if we put our minds to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And Mimo, is it Mimo? Sorry, I'm not sure.
Yeah, Mimo.
Yes, the story of a young woman, Jessie, who finds out she is pregnant the same week her grandmother is diagnosed with a terminal illness. She decides to document the progression of her pregnancy during her grandmother's final days in hopes to share those special moments with her future daughter. Wow. I watched that and I thought, so very personal. That was the words that came to my mind. Is that a personal true story that you're connected with? Because it felt so universal in so many different ways, one that could touch the hearts of everyone around the world.
Yeah, I mean, that was the goal. The goal was to make a film that everyone could relate to. And some filmmakers refer to that as like kitchen sink content. You know, you want something that's just like, it can pull on the heartstrings of literally any and everyone. But I also wanted to nuance that from a advocacy perspective of like maternal mortality and generational healing and things like that. It somewhat is a personal story. My grandfather, who recently he passed on, but my cousin, she had her daughter, and when he was holding her, he was like, wow, I didn't think that I would ever get a chance to see my great-grandchild or live long enough to see a great-grandchild. And that's what really inspired me to write that script, because there are people in our lives, our grandparents, who we are used to being, you know, being as a part of our lives since we were children forever. But our children may never get to meet that person that means so much to us. And it's sad, it's jarring, but it's also, I love the fact that we have technology now, you know, and how can we keep those memories of this person that we love so dearly alive for future generations to come. And so that's what inspired me to write the script. The film was made for $850 in 3 days in Atlanta. And me and my friends just got together and made it in two locations. That was that.
So and you act in it, you're in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find that?
I mean, I got into filmmaking by acting. So I love acting. Yeah, I love acting. Slowly getting back into it with my upcoming project, because I took a break from it to focus on directing. But I love acting. I love it. And the nice thing about Mima, it was mostly improv. It was mostly narration. So it was something that I could easily focus on while directing. It wasn't like I had to like memorize lines.
Yeah.
So it was a very low lift type of film, you know, that was easy to pull off.
Because I myself and other people listening can share your experiences in many ways, because I was a former actor who got into filmmaking, but I haven't looked back in that way. It's not something I'll be doing anytime soon, acting.
Yeah.
what was the reason for you to step behind the camera?
A couple different reasons. I went to school, I majored in marketing and I minored in acting for undergrad. And then I went to graduate school for cinema production after, it was my senior year of my undergraduate program. in two different instances. One, I was interning at a talent agency, and I thought that I really wanted to go, you know, in front of the camera, but then I realized that there's a whole world of careers and jobs behind the scenes. And I was so focused on the in front of the camera roles and acting that I didn't even realize that there was a whole industry of people who made that happen. And so that was one instance where I was like, okay, I want to get behind the scenes. The other was I was acting in an independent film. I was one of the lead actresses in it. It was, again, my senior year. And we were about 2 hours behind schedule. And it was like one of the most chaotic sets, but there was so much running around, but nothing was, at the same time, nothing was getting done. And I'm like, who is running this? Like, who is running the production? And that's when I started to look into producing. And I'm like, everybody thought that I wanted to go to graduate school. When I said I wanted to go to school for film and get my master's, everyone thought I wanted to go for directing. And I'm like, no, I want to go for the person who is overseeing the entire production process logistically. I think so much of filmmaking is centered around the creative and not enough is centered around the logistics of a production, like your script breakdown, your budgets, your schedules, selecting your team, the contract negotiations. Like, producers literally have a hand in the entirety of the production process. That's also why I enjoy that aspect of producing commercials, because it keeps me sharp in being able to execute an idea and make it something that's real. So that's those two instances, being on that set and interning at a talent agency, led me to get my master's degree in producing.
That's something I 110% agree with. The amount of times I've seen the chaos when I was an actor, or just sitting around wondering why people are running around and nothing's really moving on. Nothing's changing at the moment. Or why is this person doing that when someone else is just doing that? And why am I being told this is all so important?
Yeah.
Yeah. If it's so important, why is it looking like everything's lastminute.com?
Yeah. Right.
Gosh.
Right.
You know, just weird things. I remember looking at a camera guy and I thought to myself, he didn't do something right. But I didn't know anything then. And I was right. He messed out. He filmed some of it at 720p and the rest of it at 1080p, or, you know, something, problem with aspect ratios and things like that. Just really what I would call kind of basic things that went wrong that day. And you are right about that. And that's the great thing about your podcast, because it's the anti-Hollywood route to film production, and it can get people going, the micro-budget indie filmmakers podcast. Now, it's clear you're passionate about independent film, you know, that's obvious, and you can really do it. But what made you want to start the podcast?
A lot of filmmakers were reaching out to me about my process, and I used to teach film workshops at film festivals, and I used to also do consultations for filmmakers, but that started to get overwhelming with producing commercials full-time, making my independent films, and getting into commercial directing, you know, slowly. It was like, I was booking consultations at one point, like once a day, and that was just too much for me. So I'm like, where can I put all of this information in a concise way that is accessible to filmmakers, where it can just kind of live on its own and be a resource to them? And so that's what prompted me to make the podcast. I knew from the beginning that this was going to be a limited series. So it's a 3-season limited series podcast that takes filmmakers through the entire production process, from like script all the way to screen. So season one, it covers your pre-production. Season two, it covers production. And season three, it covers marketing, distribution, and marketing and branding. And each season has a corresponding workbook with templates that I use. And so the podcast now has a Twitter page of over 3,000 followers, and we have a website where the workbooks are hosted. And a lot of filmmakers have reached out and said, like, the podcast is the reason that they've made their first film, and they're onto their second, or they're onto their third. And it really is the micro budget resource-based approach. The goal was to provide the tangible, tactical, logistical advice and not a podcast, not in a format that like I'm talking into oblivion. You know, there's unlimited episodes. It's like, no, there's 15 episodes. There's a beginning, middle, and end. By the end of this, you should know how to make a film. And that was the goal of it. So, and it's definitely, it's definitely saved me some stress too. I will say that.
Good, good. And you did mention in one episode about talking too much. You said, I'm not going to talk too much. I think you referred to someone who helped you with the podcast, shaping up some of the things you say beforehand. I can't remember completely.
Yes, yes. So my co-producer, Sierra, she has a background in journalism and documentary filmmaking. And what we did was we created a outline for the each episode of what we were going to like talk about. And then from there, she would listen to it and transcribe it and create a script with time marks of like, okay, this is... this episode about pre-production, you could use this section, rearrange that part with this section. Like she made a really in-depth script and then I edited those episodes. And yeah, that's how that came about. I could not have done it without her.
Oh, good, good. It's always good to have someone to help out. Especially with your one, it is such a benefit to filmmakers. And you mentioned how many followers you have on Twitter. But what I think is really good, really, really exceptional in many ways, is your tweets encourage conversation and I wouldn't say debate, but conversation and encouragement to interact with other filmmakers. Because there's so many great tweets you put out there. And there's ones about, you know, drop a breakthrough still from your film's budget and your still, it looks beautiful. And you put down what is called Daughters of Eve and the budget was $7,000. Mm-hmm. When these people tweet and interact with you, does it ever encourage you to watch much of their work and interact with them further? And I only ask because you're building up a family here from your podcasts and on Twitter. So how does it work out for you?
It absolutely encourages me to watch the work of other filmmakers. I'm constantly inspired by the filmmakers that follow the podcast page and my page. There's so many different types of filmmakers out there. And I think that one of the reasons why my podcast is successful is because it's created from an abundance mindset. I don't believe that, I don't believe in gatekeeping. I think that there's room for everyone at the table.
Yeah.
There's no two filmmakers that are alike. And seeing the work of all the filmmakers that either respond or they drop their links to their work and just looking at even like trailers or proof of concepts of the work that they have or even scripts like log lines. I'm like, this is so different. It's something that I would never think to do. And just thinking about, these filmmakers are all over the globe as well. South Africa, Canada, London. It's incredibly inspiring, incredibly inspiring.
And you mentioned branding and marketing, which I think sometimes filmmakers, we really need help with and really need guidance in terms of what to do. Because a lot of people make the great film, their great film, they were inspired to do it, it's what they wanted to do. But then it's a case of what's next or what do I do now? How do I get it out there? Mm-hmm. Did you ever have a situation when you wasn't experienced in terms of marketing and branding and you had a film that you had just made and you didn't know what to do with it?
Fortunately, no, because my background in marketing came before my background in film.
I see.
So I had my undergraduate degree, my bachelor's in marketing communication. And so I was always making films from the standpoint of where is this going to live? Who is the audience for this film? And honestly, marketing and distribution is one of my favorite parts of filmmaking. If I'm being completely honest, I love taking a finished product and getting it to the audience that I intended for it to reach. And each of my films have a different marketing strategy. Unlearning Sex was completely different from Black Feminist, was completely different from Daughters of Eve, completely different from my shorts. And I always make films thinking, okay, who's going to watch this? Who's going to resonate with it? And that influences my festival distribution list. A lot of filmmakers are going for Sundance and they're going for Cannes and they're going for like all of these major film festivals when really the audience that would resonate most with your film might be this local film festival in Utah. Yeah. Some of the best film festivals for unlearning sex were North Dakota Human Rights Film Festival. There's other film festivals in New York. It's New York Inspirational Film Festival. There's just so many that speak to, like, the audience that is drawn to that festival have the same core values that the film is trying to, like, enforce. And so for me, it's a puzzle. It's a game. I thoroughly enjoy it. I also love thinking of different ways to distribute my film. It's not just through the festival circuit. You know, there's schools and organizations, and there's film events, and there's museums, even NFTs, you know, as people who are slowly getting into, like, Web3, like, there's a lot of different ways to just get your film out there outside of the traditional Hollywood model. And that's the fun part for me.
See, that sounds amazing, the different types of distribution models you have and how you approach different academic institutions or film institutions, like this regular distribution companies in that way. So how would it differ? How would your approach differ if you was to approach, for example, Harvard University and then approach Quelle TV?
Well, I work with distributors for my documentaries. So, like, I particularly with my educational docs, I partner with an educational library distributor who has those relationships already with those schools. So they handle all the distribution, which is great. Quelle TV, it's a platform that's basically like the Black indie Netflix.
Yeah.
It's a platform specifically for Black films by Black filmmakers. And a lot of my films fit that criteria. Some don't. Like, I've submitted several films to them and they have two of mine. But it's my approach is really just contingent upon, again, just what audience would resonate with my film. There are films like Meemaw. Meemaw is on Quelle TV, mm-hmm. and it makes sense as to why.
Yeah.
Unlearning Sex is distributed, and Black Feminist is distributed by my university library distributor. And those are educational films, and it makes sense as to why. So yeah, I guess my approach is just contingent upon where the audience is and how I reach them.
Excellent. I really like what you mean by that. And it makes sense completely. I have two films on Quelle TV myself, and it's where I can watch your work, some of it that I've seen, and I get what you mean. But the whole Harvard University and the academic libraries situation in terms of having films there, that is interesting to say the least. I mean, I think I read that on your Twitter feed too, that filmmakers don't just think of the usual places to go to get your film distributed. Think of other places such as libraries and academic institutions and places like that. You have done so many films, you've produced so many great ones. What one would you say to an indie filmmaker to watch if they're interested in producing their own documentary film, not just because of the quality of the film, but because of how you managed to write, direct, produce it, and get it out there to the world?
I think Unlearning Sex is a really good one. I also think Black Feminist is another really good one. I rarely make story-driven documentaries. My sweet spot with documentaries is educational, just because there's just a huge market with educational library distribution. And now that a lot of film schools and a lot of just schools in general are remote, being assigned a film to watch and being able to have a curriculum in accordance with that film or a study guide in accordance with that film is something that a lot of academic institutions are gravitating towards. And so I like making educational documentaries because it also, you know, you're able to take a subject that may be really broad and narrow it down and hone in on a specific aspect of that or a specific viewpoint of that. So if you're looking for educational documentaries, I would definitely say any of my docs are great examples of that in particular. If you're looking for story, I would definitely say my shorts definitely cater more towards narrative, more towards story driven things as opposed to subject things. But yeah.
You heard that, everyone. Look out for him. Look out for him. Go and find him. I'll be putting your website and lots of details about you in the show notes. That's for sure, for everybody to check out and watch and listen to and read about. But finally, before we finish up, what can we see from you in the future? What's next?
So my latest film that I just finished, I wrapped production in February, and we just finished the picture lock, the color, the sound. And next week we submitted to festivals for the first time. It's called New Santa. It's about the North Pole doing a diversity, equity, and inclusion overhaul. Great. And firing Santa and replacing him with a Black woman named Shaniqua Claus. And it kind of turns the whole gift giving thing on its head, because now the North Pole has an equitable system where gifts are given on household income.
Oh.
And so it's funny. It makes you think. And I love taking necessary conversations and putting them in comedy form. But it's a 12-minute short, and I'm really excited to get that one out there. Also, what's next for me is definitely growing my podcast in different ways. The episodes are done, they are there, but I've been partnering with a lot of different film festivals to bring micro budget workshops and networking events to film festivals. Like I said, exploring NFTs and different partnerships where filmmakers, micro budget filmmakers, can distribute their work and actually get consistent revenue from that. And more film challenges for the micro budget film podcast. We have quarterly film challenges. We've done a documentary film challenge. We've done a Halloween film challenge. So continuing to grow the micro budget pod page and base, is definitely something that I'm going to be putting a lot of work into, in 2022.
Gosh, that is a lot of work. And that film just sounds amazing. How did you think of the idea of, the Santa Claus being a Black woman and all these other type of things happening, because it's so traditional, wrongly, obviously, that Santa Claus is just a white guy?
I just thought that, after really 2020, at the start of the uprising, I think that a lot of companies were frantically like, what are our DE&I efforts? And you see a lot of companies posting the black squares or like trying to be in solidarity, or you see all of a sudden so-and-so is the, CEO or chief operations officer, or they're like throwing diverse people in the executive leadership roles to make the company look good. Like, it was a very chaotic scramble. And I witnessed that firsthand from being in advertising. Okay. And I thought it part of it was just funny to me how everyone, all of these companies just started to panic and think about things that they should have been thinking about all along. And I was just sitting there like, what if fictional companies did like DE&I overhauls? And I was like, yeah, like the North Pole. And then I was like, oh, that would be actually really funny. And I wrote the script in one sitting just because I had the idea. And it came together exactly how I pictured it in my brain. Like, it just kind of came to me in light of everything that was going on. And that's just what inspired me to write it on a whim.
That's really good. I've never tried that. I'm definitely going to try it now. I usually think, okay, I've got this idea. Next week I'll sit down when I have the time and blah, blah, blah. And then to be fair, it kind of wanes, or it's not as strong, or the enthusiasm or whatever is not quite right. But I'm definitely going to try that type of situation in terms of how to get the script written and done when the idea is right in your head. And your workshops, what will they be about? Well, obviously I know what they'll be about, but what will be included in the workshops?
So the workshops are basically a version of the podcast. Like, we'll go over the micro budget process from script to screen. And the nice thing is, in those workshops, I showcase examples of my films and I talk about specifics, like processes with those films. So I'll show two or three of my films, break those down. And the workshop is an hour long. And then afterwards, there's a speed networking or speed bartering session, as I like to call it. A lot of filmmakers, like, we don't have the budgets to pay these day rates, but it's like, you know what? I'm a cinematographer and you're an editor, so I'll shoot your film if you edit mine. or I'm a writer and you're a director, so I will script supervise your film if you direct mine. Or I'm an actress and I'm willing to just like get work on my reel. So like that is the energy that I bring to those workshops. And some of the best ones I've had are in Brooklyn, New York. It was over 80 students that were there, 80 filmmakers that were there, and a lot of them collaborated. And the pandemic slowed that down for sure, but I'm looking forward to getting back into the workshops and bringing it to festivals.
Excellent. I love that. I love that so much, that type of workshop. And even the changing of the word from networking to bartering means something. Because we have a lot of networking events, but maybe they're not what they could be or what they should be, depending on what you want and how you think, I guess. So,
for sure.
I love that. Zana, thank you so much for coming on and dropping all of the knowledge that you did on this episode of the podcast. I really, really appreciate it. And I can't wait to see what's coming from you next. And I definitely want to see that Santa film. I want to see the trailer. It just sounds brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I had a lot of fun.